You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Thank you, Peter and David. That was a terrific way to kick all this off and remind us of the full range of challenges. We heard Peter and David discuss uncertainty around congressional action in a number of different regards around fiscal policy, but even on regulatory matters. And in light of that, it's the next panel is particularly relevant. I want to start by reminding that a main partner for this event is Governance Studies here at Brookings. Darrell West is the vice president, and I have been a senior fellow and now non-resident senior fellow for over 10 years in governance studies, and it's a real pleasure to work with them on this event. Unfortunately, Sarah Binder, who was supposed to be on this panel back in September, was not able to join us today, but I think we've filled in quite well. We're going to be looking at how Congress dealt with the crisis and the bailout, the status of and nature of bipartisanship in Congress a decade ago and perhaps today, and how did the Hill respond in the immediate aftermath and beyond, and what do we learn from all of that? And we've got a terrific panel. John Lawrence from the University of California's Washington Center for 38 years served as a staff member in the House, including as chief of staff to Nancy Pelosi. I mentioned at the outset, if you weren't here, John's terrific article in The Atlantic, which just came out last week, which is a sort of TikTok through the days of the crisis. I think it's required reading for anybody who's interested in this topic. Francis Lee from the University of Maryland teaches courses in American government, public policy process, legislative politics, political ambition, and political institutions, and it's a great pleasure to have her with us today and to see her again. And finally, a dear friend of the Miller Center, Dan Meyer, who was on the advisory council for our first-year project, who is assistant and before that deputy assistant to the president for legislative affairs for George W. Bush, and is now with the Duberstein Group, and before that had served on Capitol Hill working for Speaker Newt Gingrich. Today's panel is moderated by David LeBlanc, a Miller Center faculty member, also in the Department of Politics at UVA. He is the J. Wilson Newman Professor of Governance at the Miller Center. Their full bios are in the packets out back or that you may have with you, and I'm going to turn it over to David to get us started. Thanks, David.
Thanks. And thanks, everybody, for coming out. And a special thanks to David and Peter for what really is a great introduction to this panel. I mean, it stands on its own. But what we're going to focus on during this morning's discussion are the legislative politics, the popular politics that were going on during the course, not just of the bailout, but as we think about the transition from Bush to Obama and the ways in which the nature of America's political system and political representation changed, and how we saw that from 2008 and then with the political changes in 2010, the rise of the Tea Party, Occupy Wall Street, etc. And so one way to get this started before I ask our panelists to give some prepared remarks is to try and remember where you were when you thought about how political the crisis was or was about to become, right? We saw this as an economic crisis. Certainly, it was a housing crisis, and we saw the housing markets crash. It was a financial crisis. Securities markets were declining. We knew that the Fed was doing and engaged in extraordinary kinds of policy. Right. But it also became a political crisis. And I'll tell you an image that is indelible in my mind. And it's the morning or the day when the Congress, when the House took up the initial TARP bill. And I remember watching CNBC because I was interested to seeing how the markets were going to respond to floor debate on the TARP. And what was striking to me is that on C-SPAN, the anchors, and I can't remember who the anchors were, they were turned around watching the TV behind them, watching C-SPAN, right? Now, if any of you have ever turned on C-SPAN, you know that this is not riveting television, okay? But that day, it was riveting, right? The anchors were watching, people at home were watching, and the markets were watching, right? There was a moment when a member on the House looked over at somebody on the other side of the floor and did this. right, to indicate that the markets had just fallen by 500 points, right? And I sat as a political scientist and somebody interested in financial markets waiting to see what was going to happen, right? Is this going to change the nature of debate in the House? Are people going to be alarmed about the well-being of American consumers? Did we care about spillovers to global markets? And we saw more and more votes and more debates. And at the end of the first day, the House voted down TARP, and it resulted in one of the single largest drops in the Dow in history since the Great Depression. Right. So that to me is indelible. Right. And it's also indelible when we hear discussions just this week about how broken the political system is. Right. And you think, well, wait a second. This is broken. Right. Let's think back 10 years and think about what it looks like. And rather than me thinking through it myself, I thought, why don't we assemble people who know an awful lot more about legislative politics and can help us together think about what the nature of legislative politics was, how we can think about legislating during times of crisis, and then get some real deep insight into what was going on during not just TARP, but the auto bailout and fiscal stimulus and the whole range of activities that we won't get through, but that we can begin talking about through this session. So I'm going to ask Francis Lee to go first. Francis, along with being a prolific scholar, has a book coming out edited with Nolan McCarty, which I think is really appropriate in this at this moment. They have a book coming out, and I don't think it's out yet, Francis, is that right? But it's coming out with Cambridge, and it's called Can America Govern Itself? Hopefully at the end of the session, she'll be able to answer that question pretty definitively, but we'll let that build for a little bit. So, Francis.
And to David LeBlanc for inviting me to participate. My role today is to reflect back on Congress's handling of the 2008 financial crisis. Now, I think everyone would agree that the Federal Reserve and the Treasury were both more important players than was Congress, but Congress nevertheless had a critical role to play. This morning, I'm going to argue that Congress exceeded our usual expectations for the institution, just as the government's overall response to the crisis exceeded expectations. Now, this is not to say that the performance in either case was optimal, but the response to the financial crisis did prevent a second Great Depression, a very real prospect at the time, and it did so at surprisingly low cost to the taxpayer. Now, admittedly, exceeding expectations is a low bar for Congress, an institution that struggles to reach a 20% approval rate. So I'm going to begin by laying out three stereotypes that Congress overperformed in key ways. Then I will conclude by focusing on Congress's role as a policy legitimator. In many ways, policy legitimation is Congress's most important function in the crisis, even more important than the specifics of the legislation that it enacted. It's typical for pundits and political scientists to analyze Congress as if it were an institution made up of single-minded seekers of re-election. But no analysis that prioritizes the re-election incentive can explain how Congress managed to muster 263 votes in the House and 74 votes in the Senate to approve a $700 billion bailout for the financial industry. Re-election incentives also cannot do much to explain how members passed the complex Dodd-Frank regulatory reforms that not one in 100 Americans could understand. Rather, members enacted these laws in the face of electoral incentives to the contrary. Considering how outraged the American public was by the very idea of bailing out the financial industry, the electorally safe course on the TARP bailout was to vote no and hope yes. Individual members had every incentive to dodge responsibility and just hope that someone else or some other institution would contain the spiraling crisis. Their re-election interest was to keep their hands clean of the unpopular work that was necessary to stop the panic. So Congress faced a huge collective action problem as it confronted the financial crisis. Electoral incentives can tell us why it was so hard for Congress to act and why TARP failed the first time, but it cannot shed much light on the successful action that Congress did take. The kind of actions that are needed to mitigate a financial crisis inevitably fly in the face of the public's ideas of justice and fair play. TARP was a miserably tough vote for members of Congress. The crisis forced many members of Congress to strike their own profiles in courage, even if it was the last thing that they wanted to do. Numerous members said that they resorted to prayer and Bible study as they tried to figure out the right course of action. North Carolina conservative Sue Myrick voted for the legislation, saying that I had to do the right thing, even though politically it might kill me. Political danger was real, and members who supported it would indeed go on to face negative consequences. Senator Robert F. Bennett of Utah would later be defeated in his Republican primary by an anti-TARP challenger. In 2010, the Washington Post published an honor roll of what it called the TARP martyrs, members who lost their seats at least in large part due to their willingness to vote for the bailout. So regardless of your assessment of the legislation on its merits, it's clear that members who voted for it did not believe that they were acting in their best political interest. They did it because they believed they were acting in the country's best interest. Another long-standing stereotype about Congress is that it's an institution in which individual members focus less on national issues than on serving particularized benefits for local constituencies. This kind of politics was not absent from the response to the financial crisis, but it is not central to understanding the congressional response. When the Bush administration first came to Speaker Pelosi to ask for congressional support for the bailout, she said she thought it would be easier for her to round up the support for the bailout if it were combined with a modest stimulus package. A sweetener would give members cover as they voted for the very unpopular $700 billion bailout. But the administration held the line against the inclusion of a stimulus. And the initial TARP package to which Pelosi agreed and then presented to the House contained no fiscal stimulus and thus no sweetener. When the first vote failed in the House, the action then moved on to the Senate. When the Senate advanced its version of TARP, it did so by extending a range of individual and business tax breaks popular with members, along with a large boost in FDIC deposit insurance. This package of sweeteners was undoubtedly helpful in building and broadening support for the TARP, first in the Senate and then in the House. But I don't think it would be fair to characterize providing these benefits as Congress's primary focus. These tax breaks would likely have been extended as part of some other legislative vehicle if they hadn't hitched a ride on the TARP. Skipping forward to the fiscal stimulus passed in 2009, the $787 billion American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, it's actually striking how little pork barrel politics played in the passage of this package. Some colleagues at the University of Maryland and I did an analysis some years ago of the geographic distribution of funds from the stimulus. And we found that biases resulting from pork barrel politics played very little role in explaining how states and districts fared in receipt of stimulus funds. The districts and states represented by members of the appropriations and transportation and infrastructure committees gained little special benefit. Likewise, states and districts represented by members of the majority party got no additional funding from the package. Congress simply didn't live up to the stereotype of institution oriented towards pork barrel politics in its response to the financial crisis. A third stereotype about the contemporary Congress is that it is relentlessly partisan. It's true that partisan conflict in Congress has been trending upward since the 1970s. But in responding to the financial crisis in 2008, Congress was remarkably bipartisan. The first legislative response to the crisis came in the summer of 2008 with the Housing and Economic Recovery Act giving authority to Treasury to take Fannie and Freddie into government conservatorship. In other words, a Democratic Congress was persuaded to give a Republican Treasury Secretary sweeping new authority, what Secretary Paulson referred to at the time as a bazooka. The legislation passed with overwhelming support from House Democrats and a big bipartisan vote in the Senate. The TARP bailout also passed with strong bipartisan support in both House and Senate. This is quite an accomplishment when you consider the powerful partisan impulses that are involved when tough votes like this present themselves. Crisis not only occurred during divided government, but also just about a month out from a closely fought presidential election. Political incentives for working across party lines were about as low as they could be. Think about the situation from the Democrats' point of view. Leader Pelosi had to ask Democrats to give the Bush administration a sum nearly the size of the annual Defense Department budget in order to bail out the very people and institutions who were responsible for the crisis. Think about the situation from Republican leader John Boehner's point of view. It's not easy to ask a minority party in Congress to shoulder the burdens of governing. Faced with the bank bailout, the minority party had every incentive to keep its hands clean of this unpopular business, to make the majority party vote for it, just like the minority party in Congress normally does with the debt limit, make the majority party put up the votes to raise the debt limit. But in the end, almost half of Republicans voted for it. Before wrapping up, I want to conclude by considering Congress's role in the financial crisis as a policy legitimator. One of Congress's great strengths as a political institution is its longstanding tendency to legislate on the basis of broad coalitions encompassing majorities of both parties. Despite the rise of party polarization in Congress, this pattern has not faded. Important legislation still almost always passes with wide support from the congressional minority party. In fact, the coalitions that result in the enactment of laws are no more partisan today than they were in the 1970s. It includes routine legislation as well as important legislation. The Affordable Care Act, enacted with no minority party buy-in, has not become the norm. Such legislation has not even become more common. The congressional response to the financial crisis was enacted on bipartisan lines, granting it wider legitimacy and public acceptance than it would have otherwise had. Furthermore, the torturous way in which it was enacted also increased public acceptance. When the House first considered the bailout, public sentiment was overwhelmingly opposed to it. Calls were coming into congressional offices opposing the legislation at a rate of 100 to 1. The Pew Research Center reported that 6 in 10 Americans said they felt angry about the government's plan. So the House's initial irresolution and inability to pass the legislation on the first try was what you should expect from an institution attuned to public attitudes. Congress was acting in its representative capacity. When the bill was on the verge of going down, Financial Services Chairman Barney Frank warned the leadership not to try any heroics by keeping the vote open and twisting arms. He said after it failed, he said it would have been a terrible mistake to put this through. It would have been scandalous. But then, when the Dow saw its largest one-day drop in history, public opinion shifted. Calls coming into congressional offices were more mixed, more favorable, more willing to see Congress do something. Members reported talking to constituents who saw fear in their eyes. Now, the bailout never became popular, but the public was much less harshly opposed to it when it passed on October 3rd than it had been in late September when Congress first considered it. The process in Congress had helped to soften public opposition and to build legitimacy for what was a difficult and risky policy endeavor. And throughout, and despite its poor public image, Congress rose above narrow interests and partisan interests to do what it saw as in the country's best interest.
Thank you, Francis. So John Lawrence, who Bill has already mentioned this essay, I will mention it again. You know, when we were putting this together, John sent us on Monday an essay that just came out in The Atlantic called When America Stared Into the Abyss, The Untold Story of How America's Political Leaders Crossed the Aisle to Stave Off the Financial Collapse in 2008. So John's going to tell us a little bit about what's in that essay, but not everything. He's going to leave the ending as a mystery, so you go out and buy a copy of The Atlantic. But John?
Thank you, David. I'd love to say that my timing on the publication of this article was planned, but it, like most things in politics, it wasn't. It was just fortuitous, but it is helpful that came out just as this conference was being scheduled. I also want to say I want to thank David and Francis and obviously Dan for all being here, and I particularly want to thank Brookings for scheduling a session that looks at the legislative aspects of what happened in TARP. I think very often, as I've particularly when we went through the 10th anniversary a few months ago, I was struck by how often the conversation seemed to revolve almost exclusively around activities that took place at the executive level and at the regulatory level. And then there was very often an annotation somewhere along the lines that, oh, and then Congress passed TARP. And as an afterthought, having been there throughout the crisis, not only on the floor and working with members, but in lots of private meetings with members of the House, the Senate, and the and administration, it was not an afterthought. And I'm grateful that we're giving some attention here to the role that the legislative branch played in that process. And the article that David mentioned really is part of a longer research effort that I'm making, which utilizes the notes that I took as Mrs. Pelosi, as the Speaker's chief of staff, in many conversations and meetings, telephone calls during the course of this and many other developments that I think reveal the kind of interchange that took place among the individuals and among the institutions as this crisis evolved. I think it's important. Let me just add to a few of the very insightful observations that Francis, as usual, offered. I think it's important to remember exactly what the atmosphere was here legislatively, congressionally, politically at the time that this emerged. Remember that Democrats had taken over the Congress in the 2006 election after 12 years in the minority. So we had divided government. We had also a election, as Francis mentioned, only a few weeks away. And to me, very often when I'm interviewed about some aspect of my career on the Hill, people will say, what was the most significant thing that you think happened during the Pelosi speakership, the first speakership, I guess I have to say now. Most people, I think I'm going to say the Affordable Care Act, but I actually say TARP. I think that the TARP legislation was the most extraordinary example of political leadership I saw, in part because of its complexity, because of the speed with which it occurred, but particularly it occurred only a few weeks before an election. And it happened in the context of a long period of time during that Democratic majority of 2007 and early 2008, where there was a great deal of contentiousness between the administration and the Congress over a variety of issues. There was disagreement over the regulatory activities with respect to the financial markets and to the housing industry. But there was also enormous battles taking place over the Iraq policy. There were battles taking place over stem cells, which involved a veto by President Bush. There were, as an ongoing battle, which actually transcended the TARP battle over continuing resolution and spending. So it was not nearly, I think, at the level of partisan gridlock that we see today. But there was a great deal of mistrust, and there was a good deal of partisan battling that had been going on institutionally between the executive and the legislative branches when this crisis emerged. I think probably no event, no day will stand out in my memory, my nearly 40 years on the Hill, as much as September 18th, 2008. It was quite a stunning, and I relay this in the article, it was quite a stunning conversation the Speaker had with Secretary Paulson and with Chairman Bernanke when they called and they said, we think we really need to have a meeting with the joint congressional leadership. And Mrs. Pelosi said, okay, it's a Thursday night. It's kind of tough to do. People are getting on airplanes. They're leaving town. We can do that at the beginning of the week. And Mr. Bernanke said, well, there may not be a national economy by the end of the weekend, so we need to have that meeting a little earlier. And we had this meeting in the Speaker's office that night, not surprisingly, with the joint bipartisan bicameral leadership and Secretary Paulson and Mr. Bernanke and Dan, you probably were there, and Candy, where we were told that we were going to have to pass legislation of an enormous size, $700 billion, $500 to $700 billion. And both then and subsequently, people from the Treasury said, we're not exactly sure where that figure came from, But, you know, we think that's what we need. That's the kind of numbers that we need to look at. And Senator Reid's reaction was, and I quote him in the article, I say, if you think the United States Senate is going to give you $500 billion next week, that's just not happening. Your timetable is unrealistic. It takes 2 weeks to pass a bill to flush a toilet in the United States Senate. To which Secretary Paulson responded, well, if we don't do this, we're going to flush the toilet on the American people. Okay, so not the best environment for beginning these specific negotiations. Thank you very much. One thing I think is really important to understand, which I always talk to my students about, and because there is such a generalized way of viewing congressional activity, you know, Congress passed TARP, there's an expectation that there's one congressional response, or even there's even a two-party congressional response. And in the case of TARP, that wasn't the case. There were many divisions within the parties as well as between the two houses of Congress, not to mention the disagreements that I've already referenced with respect to the executive branch. There were what I would call the Democratic pragmatists, people like Pelosi, Chairman Barney Frank, who looked at this situation and said, "Look, this is not a great situation, but we are in the position of leadership. We have to act. You know, whatever disagreements we have with the administration or with how the crisis evolved, we're in charge and we have to respond." But that was not by any means the only response that we had within the Democratic caucus. We had liberals, people from the CBC, people from the Congressional Black Caucus, people from the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, other ideological liberals who were utterly bemused in the notion that here a few weeks before an election, which was, remember, a presidential as well as a congressional election, we were being asked to provide hundreds of billions of dollars to probably the most unpopular human beings on the face of the earth, who had precipitated the crisis. And from the liberal standpoint, they were getting nothing for this. They wanted a stimulus. We had passed this stimulus in February of 2008, a relatively small one. The economic crisis had continued to worsen. Many people were saying, and in fact, we had already begun work on a second stimulus, and there was nothing that they saw in the administration's request having to do with stimulus. But increasingly, there was nothing on foreclosure mitigation. There was nothing to help low-income people who were losing their houses. So many of these Democratic liberals and members who represented minority communities saying, why would I vote for a piece of legislation that bails out the financial markets and my people are getting nothing? I've got to go back this weekend or next week and explain to them that I voted for that. And we had conservatives. We had the Blue Dogs and other conservatives for whom the idea of spending this kind of money with no immediate prospects of seeing it come back was extremely problematic. And of course, as is not surprising, you had a large number of people who ideology notwithstanding, they were first-term members. That's how the Democrats had become the majority party in 2006. They were running for re-election for the first time. They weren't really terribly excited about going home and announcing that this was the most important vote they had taken. On the Republican side, I would say we had very much the same breakdown, with the exception you didn't have a lot of the Republican liberals, but you had the Republican pragmatists, people like John Boehner, who ultimately called TARP a crap sandwich. Not publicly,
that,
but
that was a sanitized version.
Yes, I know. I'm. This is a distinguished crowd, right? And I had to get it past the Atlantic censors, anyway. And McConnell, who at the White House meeting said, you know, he didn't like it, but if we need to do it, we need to do it. But you also had Republican hardliners. You had people who saw themselves in the minority, saw no particular reason that they had to stick their necks out. You had many people from rural areas in both parties. We lost lots of folks from in the Democratic Party and many in Republicans as well, who saw no particular advantage in bailing out what they saw as Wall Street or the financial industry. So institutionally, even within the Congress, this was a very, very tough mix to put together and to make a credible case for. One of the other problems that really, from a legislative standpoint, complicated this response as opposed to most complicated pieces or complex pieces of legislation was its extremely short time frame, which meant that Congress did not have the opportunity to do the sorts of things that Congress likes to do to soften the blow. We didn't have time for extensive hearings. There were some perfunctory hearings, but the hearings were largely having to do with explaining the nature of the crisis. They weren't to provide the kind of extended opportunity for public testimony and expert testimony that typically you would have in any kind of a complex piece of legislation. But you also did not have the opportunity that members had, for example, to go through the kinds of markup processes in the subcommittees and the committees where they would be able to, if not actually produce the legislation they want, then at least offer the amendments so that they could go home and say, well, I offered the amendment, it didn't pass, but I tried, and then I had to vote for whatever was left. They didn't have the opportunity on the floor to offer amendments or to offer alternative pieces of legislation. This was something that, by its very nature, I think we had 12 or 13 days from the day we had the September 18th meeting to the day when the bill was on the floor, where you really had to just ram this thing through. And members, as those of you who worked on the Hill or worked with people on the Hill, they like to have a little bit of wiggle room and explain, I tried to do this, I tried to do that. They had no opportunity to do this. And it was interesting that as I went through my notes and looked how people responded to this, how several of the people at the executive level who, not the president and the vice president, but people who actually never ran for office, were very frustrated by how long the process was taking. And I quote Hank Paulson at one point, I think he said to me, or he may have said to the speaker, but I was certainly in the room, where he said, well, nothing's happening here. People are just jammering with each other. I mean, we were a couple of days into the process of deciding a massive piece of legislation with enormous political liabilities. As Francis mentioned, one of the ways that we tried on the Democratic side to soften the blow was to say we need to add sweeteners to this legislation. And certainly Mrs. Pelosi and others over and over said we have to have several features. One was we wanted some stimulus. We were talking about $65 billion in stimulus, which is almost a drop in the bucket, and when you think in terms of either what we had done in February or what we ultimately enacted in the subsequent February of 2009. There was also strong support within the Democratic caucus for adding restrictions on executive pay and executive compensation, golden parachutes, so that these companies that were going to receive large amounts of federal assistance did not use that to turn around and provide benefits for their executives. And that turned out to be a very a serious concern, legitimate concern. Only a year after this, Goldman had over $3 billion in profits and was already back providing large executive bonuses. We were not able to get most of that. We were not, in terms of compensation, some minimal restrictions, but we were not able to get anything in terms of stimulus, as Francis mentioned. The other thing that Democrats insisted upon was that there be full repayment of the TARP money. And that's kind of an interesting point. When the bill originally came up, it was a three-page bill. Ostensibly, it said, give me $700 billion and I'll see you later. Sort of the old Bluto, you know, I'll pay you for a hamburger on Tuesday. But, you know, the Congress, of course, stepped back and said, we're not going to do that. And it was a part of the Democratic response, which was we will have to have a guarantee in the legislation that there be full repayment. And as you know, TARP money, not all the auto money, but the TARP money was fully repaid with interest. Actually, the government made a fair amount of money, well over $20 billion on the TARP repayment. Going back for a moment to the dynamics, yes, being on the House floor and seeing the vote going down was not a happy day. There was, as you may remember, a lot of partisan bickering about why that actually occurred. But one of the things that clearly was a ramification from that was that it institutionally delivered a lot of leverage to the Senate. Because once the bill went down in the House, we knew, given the tightness schedule that we did not have an opportunity to ping pong this bill back and forth. We certainly, nobody was talking about a conference committee or anything formal of that sort. And so the opportunity then went to the Senate, and the Senate quickly added about $150 billion in extenders, many times what we were hoping that we would have gotten in terms of stimulus money. And when it came back, the Democrats had no choice but to accept it. The agreement initially had been that we would, the House Republicans would provide 100 votes, Democrats would provide obviously 118, but we were talking more about 150 to 170, so that there would be, like most controversial pieces of legislation, modifications of entitlements, everybody was hold hands and jump off the cliff together. Of course, this made it much tougher when we went back to the liberals in particular, and we said we now need to not only vote for the TARP legislation, but we now need to vote for tax breaks for race car drivers and for Caribbean rum or whatever the hell they stuck into it. People were thinking, why would we have to do that? Pelosi's reaction is, well, we had to do this because you people voted it down the first time. And so if we hadn't done that, the Senate would have had to take our bill because we would have passed it and left town and they would have been left with the responsibility. The question is why did this ever happen? Why were the success? And I'll try to quickly wrap up with this, and maybe in Q&A we can talk about the stimulus. I'm a strong believer in crisis. I think that really focuses the mind on Congress. I don't think that it's conceivable if Hank Paulson or Ben Bernanke or Peter Orszag had come to the Congress and said, our projections down the road are that we're going to have problems in the fiscal market and in the housing market, and we really think that we should take these steps. I mean, we did. We did pass legislation in, I think, the summer of 2008, as Francis had mentioned, that empowered the Treasury Department. But in terms of the kind of expansive role, that would have never happened. It was the urgency of the crisis. It was the imminence of the crisis. And ultimately, I think it was the stock market that dropped 777 points as the House was voting down the bill. It really focused people's attention and that got people to understand that the alternative was worse. And that really, I think, is ultimately when you see the Congress being able to supersede the kind of slow-moving, complicated, partisan institutional rivalry that is so common. However, this was not a painless exercise. I think that if you look, and I'm a historian by training, so I'm very comfortable with this piece as opposed to an economist, with looking at the ramifications historically, I do think there was a huge stigma associated. There were people who lost their seats, although not as many as people had thought. I think, again, by the time Election Day rolled around, a lot of voters understood there wasn't a good alternative to TARP, which is one of the compelling arguments. But certainly there was resentment in the Democratic community because we backed down from some of the demands. We didn't get stimulus money. We didn't get strong executive compensation. We did get the repayment issue, although that was harder to measure in terms of immediate benefit. I think one of the others is that is often overlooked and does spill over to what happens in early 2009 is that by voting this $700 billion, it really created a political problem when we got to the stimulus. People were asking in the previous panel, why didn't you have a $1.2 or $1.3 billion stimulus? One of the reasons was you had just voted a $700 billion for TARP, and there was also a CR that was pending, which was hundreds of billions of dollars. So you literally had people arriving in Congress on January 3rd of 2009 with a new president. They were just new in their terms, and they had just, between their previous votes and the new votes they were being asked, we were in somewhere in the area of $2 trillion that people were being asked to spend. That gets people's attention in Congress. So the very size of TARP, I think, ended up having ramifications with respect to how we responded to the broader economic crisis. And then lastly, I would say, I think that it did ultimately fuel partisan reactions in particular, you saw it with the rise of the Tea Party, which comes fairly quickly after. I know a lot of people's reaction is that the Tea Party was in response to the Affordable Care Act, But the Affordable Care Act was still hadn't even passed the House in the summer of 2009. I think the Tea Party really fixed on this notion that the government was rigged, that money was being spent, the taxpayers were laying out enormous amounts of money to benefit the rich and the privileged, and that wasn't benefiting the average American, the average taxpayer. And I think it had that kind of very significant impact in terms of the legitimization of this new political movement which helped to fuel both partisanship and gridlock, which we've come to associate with American politics. So with that, I'll stop and turn it over to Dan. Thank you very much.
Dan Meyer, who again has already been introduced, spent time as in the White House, served as assistant and deputy assistant to the president for legislative affairs. This is during the second Bush administration. Dan.
Thank you, David, and thanks to Bill and the Miller Center and Brookings for another excellent program. My perspective is not particularly dissimilar to John's, although I was at the White House, and before that I had his job with Speaker Gingrich. I'd been his chief of staff, and I think what I want to talk about a little bit is I'm not an academic, I'm a practitioner, but people look back at that and say, okay, well, it did work and crisis averted, and I don't think people really realize what went on in those 15 days to make that happen and how close we were to having it not happen. And had it not happened, what would the consequences have been? That's part of the problem. No one knows that. That was part of the problem why we had people, you'd have trouble getting votes for the TARP legislation in the first place. Both parties were struggling with this over the course of those 15 days, and I went to one of the meetings of the House Republicans all gathered together. And as difficult as this was for the Democrats, and I don't mean this anyway as a negative partisan shot, they were a little more comfortable on the Democratic side with the idea of government intervention than the Republicans, particularly the conservative Republicans. But Boehner had said, yes, we've got to do something, and Cantor was the whip. But I remember Paul Ryan, who at that time, I think, you know, he was well before his time in leadership, and I think maybe he was Budget Committee Chairman at the time. He may not have been that yet. It was 10 years into his career. And he stood up in front of all the House Republicans and said, look, I didn't come to Washington to do this. He was an Empower America, free market guy. He said, but what he said to all his colleagues was, but we need to do this because if we don't, the consequences could be substantial. But let me just tell you that you'll never get credit for it if we do the right thing here, because no one will understand what was avoided if we succeed. And that was one of the more salient comments that I recall through a series of meetings. Those 15 days. But it was a remarkable 15 days, and I agree with John. When I look back at my career, which, I was Newt's chief when the Republicans won the majority for the first time in 40 years, which was a big deal. That was probably the most, again, we don't know the consequences if we hadn't done it, but it was probably the most significant activity of what I was involved with through my time in government. And I apologize, I've been fighting a head cold, so I just warn you if I have to turn around and cough or sneeze. My story also begins on September 18th, and obviously there had been a considerable amount of activity and people were aware of the problems, and you'd had the Fannie and Freddie activity and you'd had Lehman Brothers and AIC and all that were going on. But that was the day that the first meeting before the evening meeting, in that afternoon there was a meeting in the Roosevelt Room where Paulson and Bernanke came and met with the president and senior staff, and where they laid out what they thought needed to be done to try to address this. And it was very clear that they felt that there was a crisis. I mean, this wasn't something manufactured. Over the course of those, I spent a lot of time with Paulson the course of those 15 days. You could tell he was not sleeping at night or barely sleeping. He wore it on his face. The president, who, every president has a lot on their plate, but but President Bush tended to handle the pressures of the job pretty well. He could. This one was really worrying him as well. And so, there, I only share that anybody who thinks that this was some sort of manufactured crisis, at least I know the leaders didn't think so, that were involved with it. Bernanke and Paulson met with the president that afternoon in the Roosevelt Room and kind of laid out what they needed, what they felt needed to happen, which would require congressional action. And I remember Paulson saying, the biggest thing I worry about is the politics of this. We were 35, 40 days at that point before a presidential and a congressional election. And the president saying to him, just tell me what needs to be done. Let me worry about the politics of the situation. But you do need to go up and brief the Congress. My recollection of that is I left that meeting and called John Lawrence, who was the Speaker's chief of staff, and said, can we do a meeting tonight? And you were very agreeable, so maybe Paulson beat me to calling this, your office. But we set up a meeting for that night in the Speaker's conference room that was a bipartisan, bicameral meeting of the leadership and the key committee chairs and ranking members of the Banking Financial Services Committees. And other, I think, a couple other committees that had financial, maybe budget or Ways and Means of Finance. But it was a packed room. Bernanke and Paulson laid out the problem. And there was a lot of back and forth. But generally, by and large, a spirit of holy cow, this is a big deal. Chris Dodd walked out of the room, and I've heard him subsequently say afterwards that, he went before the mics afterwards. There was obviously a lot of interest. They're all staked out outside the Speaker's conference room and said, this is the scariest meeting I've had in my over 30 years in Congress. And later said, I heard him say, TARP was the most unpopular, necessary thing he was ever involved with in Congress. And I think that pretty fairly captures what a lot of people thought who were involved with this activity. I lost my train of thought talking about Chris Dodd. But as John indicated, the conclusion was we got to do something. Okay, you've got our attention. We'll work with you on a bipartisan basis. The takeaway from that meeting was Treasury go and draft a bill and send it to us, and we'll take it. We'll see what we can do with it. This resulted, I can tell you, over 15 days, there were a lot of people in a lot of different places on the Hill, at the Treasury Department, at the White House, weren't getting very much sleep. They produced a bill, I think, by Sunday night. There were a lot of meetings going on. I think Sunday afternoon that bill got sent up to Congress. I can remember looking at the bill and calling head of legislative affairs for the Treasury Department, good friend Kevin Frommer, who keep in mind, I mean, Paulson was a key to getting this done because he had so much credibility with so many folks. But we looked at that bill, and it was John was generous calling 3 pages, about 2.5 pages, which I've described as send money, no questions asked. And I said to Kevin, I bet you didn't get a chance to review this very long, did you? Because, I mean, we all knew this thing wasn't going to fly in the form that it was sent there. But to their credit, the leadership took it and made the changes, started to make changes. There were some quick hearings set up in both bodies, as I recall. But again, we were hearing on a daily basis, we got to do this fast. The world's economic system might collapse tomorrow if we don't act soon. And so there was a great push. And I'm just going to touch on a couple of highlights, but just to kind of comment on how this was kind of, back and forth. One of the participants in that meeting was the ranking Republican on the Senate Banking Committee, was Shelby. Unlike the key Democrats and Boehner and Cantor and McConnell, he walked out to the mics and said, I'm not supporting this. I don't want to imply that this was a slam dunk by any means. When you're not going to get the cooperation of the ranking Republican on the banking committee, then you need plan B. And so what we did is we went to each of the leaders and say, look, designate somebody who can work with us. We're trying to do this on an expedited basis. who is your designated person that we can work with in a small group and try to get this written and move quickly? And so in the case of the Speaker Pelosi and Leader Reid, they designated the chairs of their respective committees, which was Bonnie Frank and Chris Dodd. Shelby obviously wasn't going to cooperate. So McConnell designated Judd Gregg, who was the chairman of the Budget Committee. The ranking Republican of the House Financial Services Committee was another Alabaman like Shelby, Spencer Backus. I think Shelby put him in a remarkably difficult position. He wasn't sure whether he could be helpful or not, which wasn't helpful at all to us. So Boehner appointed his number two, the whip, then Congressman Roy Blunt, who's now Senator Blunt. And so the four of them kind of became the people we were expecting to negotiate with. As John indicated, this is not the sort of thing that can, you know, it quotes Harry Reid. Paulson wanted it to happen the next day. That wasn't going to happen that way. So it did take some time. We were trying to build it to get those people in a room to negotiate, and this was – we were having difficulty getting there. And again, I go back – one of the other things I was going to mention is one of the more memorable meetings I've ever been involved with was a week later on September 25th. The first meeting was September 18th, first meetings. And so what had happened was we're in the middle of a presidential election, President Obama, or then Senator Obama, is leading all along. And it was, I mean, I think most people thought it was going to be difficult for Senator McCain, but he had a little bit of a bump come out of the convention right after Labor Day. And there was all the drill, baby, drill, all that sort of stuff. He got a little bit of a bump. The whole financial crisis was killing him. Okay, so his numbers are starting to slide. So this is my theory of the case. I've not heard from the McCain people why this actually happened. But so that on the Wednesday, the 24th, I can remember being up in the vice president's office in the Senate, which is where the Legislative Affairs team would sometimes gather when they were up on the Hill. I got a call from the White House Chief of Staff, Josh Bolton, said, "We're going to have a bipartisan bicameral meeting tomorrow on TARP." I said, "Oh, you know, really? Understand, these meetings didn't rarely, almost never happen unless Ledge Affairs initiated them. So this was very unusual." And he said, "Yeah, Senators McCain and Obama are coming," at which point, you know, my stomach sank. I thought, oh, great. You know, this isn't hard enough without involving presidential politics into it. And so, you know, I went back to the White House and basically said, you know, what? The sanitized version is, what the heck's going on? And it was basically explained to me that McCain had orchestrated this. You know, he'd called Obama, said, "Look, the country's in trouble. We should go help." And then called Bush. And apparently I didn't realize until I read John's article, he had called Pelosi and other leaders. And so the president was a little bit boxed. None of us thought this was a good idea. Again, this, you know, it's not like we needed to raise the degree of difficulty of trying to get TARP done by introducing presidential politics. So, and what was going on, the other part was going on is, again, people are trying to get to where they can be supportive. The Democrats were in a pretty good place. You know, my recollection of what the Speaker's request was of the Republicans was, we'll put up half of our of the Democratic caucus. You need to put up half of the Republican conference to vote for this thing. We're not doing this on our own. And so that's what Boehner was trying to get to, and he was having a lot of trouble. So they were exploring, well, look, if you don't do what Paulson wants, do it a little bit this way, some sort of an insurance program that Cantor and Ryan were working on, and that would be better. And so that was the context of having this meeting. I got a call that morning from one of Boehner's senior staff saying, McCain's asked me to come to the meeting to staff him. And I said, what? You know, because we had told McCain and Obama both, look, this is an official meeting. Don't bring campaign people. You both, you know, sitting senators, you have staff you could bring that are official. We're trying to make this as, you know, trying to reduce the politics of this. That's what I said to them. And so I was stunned when Boehner staffer guy said, yeah, McCain's been meeting with House Republicans. He kind of wants to represent them in the room. And so I'm staffing him on. And I said, well, that's fine. I asked him, because he worked for Boehner, so we would allow the Speaker and the leaders to bring a staffer. I said, You have Paula call John Lawrence and explain to them why there's going to be two Boehner people in the room, one staffing Boehner, one staffing McCain, because they're going to think we're setting them up for something, you know, because there was, you know, there's this political overlay of elections and presidential elections. So, but that was all fine. Those guys, you know, Boehner and Pelosi offices had worked together and had a good relationship, so they understood. When we get to this meeting in the cabinet room, and before we get to the meeting, so as this is a Ledge Affairs meeting, since it's a bipartisan, bicameral meeting, so my staff is greeting the people as they come in. The first one to arrive was Senator Obama, who had been out on the campaign trail, and he says to my staffer who met him in the lobby, and he got there a little early, he said, is there a room that when the other Democrats get here, I can chat with them briefly? And my very accommodating staffer said, sure, you know, you can go, the Roosevelt room's available. So the Democrats arrived and they all met together and chatted, which, you know, that was very smart on their part, more coordinated than the Republicans who had called this meeting, at least one of them. And so when the meeting started, the president opened it up. He's very concerned. We're trying to get this done. The senators who are running for president wanted to come to Washington to try to help. So he opens it up, turns it over to Paulson to kind of talk about the state of the crisis, how important it is, this has to go quickly. And then the normal routine for the president in a bipartisan bicameral meeting is to turn it over to the speaker. The speaker is the highest ranking member of the legislative branch, higher than the leaders of the Senate. And he turns it over to the speaker. And almost in unison, the speaker and Senator Reid say, Senator Obama is going to speak for us. At which point, I'm sitting there, my stomach drops, because I'm thinking, okay, this is going to get political really fast. This is the last thing we need. Senator Obama lays out kind of the Democrats' position in a very reasoned way. We're trying to be constructive. We're trying to be helpful. We're here to help, sort of thing. That's my shorthand of it. And so then the president, you know, this is now we're out of normal routine. Obama spoke. So who's next? He says, well, John, you know, essentially, I know the president's thinking, this meeting was your idea. Obama just went. McCain, what do you have to say? McCain deferred, said, which was very unusual for John McCain, said, I'm going to respect seniority and I'll wait my turn. It's like, what? You know, so he clearly wasn't ready to go. And so then it goes to Boehner and it says, look, we're trying to be helpful, but my people aren't going for this. We're trying to look at these other things. And you know, Paulson didn't think that was going to work. The Democrats didn't think that was going to work. Come on, you got to get your people on board. So it basically went all around the room. The Democrats were very much on point. Excuse me one second. And had stuck to their talking points, basically saying, come on, House Republicans, you got to get there. But it didn't get nasty, although then my perspective, it was Barney Frank who was the guy who was gonna put the knife in a little bit. And when it got to Barney's turn, he said, on the talking points, but then he looked right at McCain and said, and do you support what the House Republicans are trying to do? And I thought, uh-oh, here we go. And so the president didn't let him get away with that. They kept moving the discussion. But again, it got – most everybody in the room was getting a chance to speak. And finally, Senator Obama says – look, in all fairness, we still haven't heard from Senator McCain, and he's the guy who called this meeting, President Bush thought, yeah, he's right, right? You know, and all of us in the room thought he was right. He calls on Senator McCain, who read like three talking points off of a card that he had prepared beforehand, which at that point in the meeting, it didn't seem to be particularly relevant, and it was like, okay. So then the meeting got really contentious. At one point, Spencer Backus, who I think was trying to basically say the additions to the bill since Treasury had set it up were helpful, but I give him the benefit of the doubt because I don't think he was trying to make a partisan statement at all. But the way he said it, he made it sound like the Republicans had added these things, which had largely come from the Democratic side. And the speaker just almost went over the table at him, saying, "You know, you can't take credit for that." And it got contentious and. At one point, President Bush, at one point, So this is, again, this is a Ledger Affairs meeting. I'm sitting right behind him. He turns around and looks at me, does one of these. You know, right? You know, the meeting was getting out of control. Finally cut it off. He said, look, we got it. You know, this is a crisis. We've got to get it done. Basically, meeting over. And, again, there's been a lot of hostility in the room. Everybody gets up. I'm walking out with the president and the Republican leaders going to the Oval Office. I'm walking out with the Democrats. President Obama looks over, or then Senator Obama looks over, he says, can we have that room again? I said, he said, sure. And I'd worked with Steny Hoyer a lot on FISA legislation and other things, and I grabbed him and I said, look, because there, again, it was, my fear was both sides were going to go to the stakes, they're going to blast the other side. Everything we were trying to accomplish over this first week was all going to just melt away. And I grabbed Steny and I said, look, we got to calm both sides down. This is terrible if this thing blows up. I went in the Oval, and there was a lot of suspicion on the Republicans. Actually, Hank's talked about it, that Hank had been keeping Obama posted every day, and he was trying to keep McCain posted every day. McCain was less open to hearing from him, I guess. And so even in the meeting, you kind of had the sense that there were some suspicions that Hank had been part of the coordination with the Democrats. I don't know that that's true, by the way, but there was just those suspicions. I got to go quick. Sorry. This will be the end of it. I go into the Oval Office, and I said, I think the Democrats are huddling again, and I think they're going to go to the mics and blow this up. And Paulson just turned, pale. He said, what are we doing? I said, you need to go in there because you're the one with the credibility, right? So he went in, and he went charging in, and that's when he got down on one knee and said, you can't blow this up, which were the exact words I'd used with him in the Oval. And I felt bad afterwards because, the Democrats were not trying to blow it up. Consequence of that, and why I tell the story, is the only people who went to the mics were Steny Hoyer and Ed Gillespie, who was the White House communications guy. And you would have thought it was a very calm, productive meeting based on those reports. And it was, instead of that blowing up the whole process, it turned out to be a detour, in my view, a necessary detour. But we got it back on track. The hook, I apologize for going on so long telling stories. But let me stop, and we can cover anything else in the Q&A.
Thanks, Dan. So I know I have an enormous number of questions. I'm sure the audience does as well. If you have questions, can you just raise your hand so we can get a sense of how many folks? And we have people coming around with a microphone. As the mics are going around, let me just ask the panel one small question to get us started. And it's very much an inside baseball question, as most of this discussion has been. I'm very curious about that initial piece of TARP legislation that came from the White House that was, a page and a quarter. It was a page and a quarter. To what extent was there discussion, concern, conversation about the fact that we are asking for a blank check? Congress is not going to go along with this. Do we have a fear of what's going to happen to financial markets? Was that even part of the discussion?
I don't recall. I mean, I was on countless conference calls that weekend. I'm sure among a lot of people that were paying attention to the markets, that wasn't my worry. My worry was how do we get this passed? The Treasury was churning this out, and there wasn't a lot of chance even for the White House to review it before it went up. And so I think it was viewed at the time as, look, the request coming out of the meeting in the Speaker's office the night of the 18th was send us a bill that we can start working with, and that's what we did. So, or that's what they did.
My response to that would be that I think that the superficiality of the bill that was sent up for timing purposes probably didn't help the process because it did fuel a sense on the part of a number of the congressional players, and not only the Democrats, I would say that there was a naivete coming from, I think it was perceived as coming more from Treasury than from the White House. I mean, Dan and Candy Wolf and I, we had a really good working relationship, and whatever, I mean, we had met, I think, weekly, yes. You know, throughout the 2 years that I had been, we'd been the majority. There was no sense that there was a political naivete in the White House, but I think it did feel the sense that, are these guys kidding? I mean, we're just going, and I, even in the meeting, somebody used that kind of terminology. I don't think it was a major roadblock, but it did mean that we had to scramble in terms of what do we need to put in here to make this even remotely acceptable.
Francis, can you compare? I mean, do you see anything else historically, contemporarily, that looks like the kinds of legislation that TARP was, in the sense of starting with something very small, it goes down in flames, it becomes clear that it's critical, it gets resuscitated, and then ultimately passes?
I can't come up with a comparable case off the cuff right now. In fact, I've been thinking about this quite a bit. I use this case, the story of Congress's response to TARP, as the opening vignette of a concluding chapter of a textbook I work on Congress's capacity to deal with crisis. And it's getting to be a long time ago. I mean, we're having our 10-year retrospective on that, and I'm trying to think of something that young people today could could resonate to. And I think I'm going to have to tell that story one more time in the next edition.
All right. But we do have hands here, and then we'll take two at a time.
Hello. Yes. Is the mic working properly? My name is Dan Silverstein. I'm a private sector and capital markets advisor, and I was working on Wall Street during the financial crisis. And I've been waiting to ask this question of someone for 10 years. So you have no idea how delighted I am to be able to pose it to this distinguished panel. With all the jocularity in this discussion today about the no conditions of the $700 billion TARP bill, was any consideration given to the fact that the money center banks were so leveraged beyond what the comptroller of the currency would have considered appropriate, that if you infused the money center banks with $700 billion in fresh capital, they would do exactly what they did, which was to shore up their tier one capital and not infuse the banking system with liquidity, but rather starve it of capital?
And we'll take one more.
Thank you, Larry Checco. Some fantastic, insightful stories to this episode in American history. But flash forward 10 years. Could this Congress get through this miasma, or whatever you want to call it? My great fear is that should we have another emergency like this again, we can kiss what's left of the American middle class goodbye. And that's my great fear.
Unfortunately, that's less of a question. But no, let's entertain these questions.
Yeah, yeah. I've thought about that a lot. I'm going to take the second one, but I'm not in a position to be able to answer that first one about the. You would need to talk to the economists. But on the second question, so part of the reason it worked, and I'm trying to make this much briefer than my earlier, is that there were relationships that could be called upon. Hank Paulson had a lot of credibility. Ben Bernanke had a lot of credibility. As much as the Democrats had opposed the Bush agenda on war funding, remember all the Obamacare votes. There were 40-some votes to try to restrict war funding in 2007, 2008. And the speaker shut off the trade agreements that the Bush administration had negotiated. Despite all of that, it was not personal. There was no animus there. I mean, it was the speaker and the president could have conversations, and there was some animus from Harry Reid at times. It was just his personality. But even down to what John was referring to at our level, that we understood we came from different perspectives and were representing folks who had different agendas. But at some points, you have to overcome that and get some things done. And that existed. It's much harder now, I think. And part of the reason it's harder is that there's these whole industries outside of Congress and administration, but around politics that have emerged to not necessarily go after people with whom they disagree substantively, but to go after the leadership of the people with whom they agree. So one of the biggest problems for John Boehner during the Tea Party years was all, you know, the Heritage Actions and all these, you know, the cable networks and the talk radios and all those who thought that their particular job was to try to keep the leadership pure. And I'm seeing that emerge now on the Democratic side, which worries me a lot about the ability to overcome those problems and deal with the crisis.
I would reiterate that politics is very much about relationships. Sometimes political scientists, not Francis Lee, but other political scientists forget about that component, and the level of personal interactions was critical. We had worked not only with respect to the White House, but we had negotiated with Hank on the stimulus bill. We had worked on an energy bill. There was a level of trust there, notwithstanding the hot button issues of Iraq, and even as Dan was saying, between the speaker and the president, I tell this story in the article, but since many of you may not read the article, I'll just say in this White House meeting where it seemed to just be spinning out of control, and Senator McCain was giving very ambiguous responses to what he thought we should do. At one point, the president leaned over to the speaker and whispered to her, I told you you'd miss me when I'm gone. And she responded, no, I won't. But then she added, if this goes really badly, I may have to reconsider that. So, I mean, it was just, you know, there was this level of interaction that I would be concerned about whether or not exists today because of the distances between some of the key players.
So the first gentleman who asked a question about Tier 1 capital, I'm going to ask that we hold on to that until Bob Bruner has a conversation with Larry Summers. I think that's where you probably get a cleaner and clearer answer to that question. So please hang on, right? We have time, I think, for two more questions.
Thank you. Bert Ely, a banking consultant who goes back with financial crisis as well into the 80s. And we had the FIREA legislation in 1989, which was very carefully crafted when it was introduced, and it was largely passed as introduced with relatively minor tweaks. We had the fiduciary legislation in 91, took more reworking by Congress, but still, when I listened to the description of what Treasury set up to deal with the last crisis, my question is this. Why was there such a difference? Why was there this belief that they could just send up this very small bill without having thought through all of the details that ultimately had to be worked out once it was introduced? Because that's so different than what the experience was in 89 and 91.
Well, you're 89.
Hang on 91. One second. Let's see if we can grab one more right behind you.
Hi, my name is Prashant Rathore, and my question is you guys consider the financial situation a crisis, and you acted very quickly. What else would you consider a major crisis, and would you act in a similar way as you did back 10 years ago?
So, thank you. So I'm going to ask each of our panelists to address that set of questions. I'm going to start with Francis and go on down the line.
What creates a perception of crisis? It's hard to answer such a question in the abstract. I mean, clearly there was a broad consensus among elite opinion. If you followed the op-ed pages of the major newspapers, it was almost like wartime in September of 2008, that they felt that it was a test of whether American institutions could rise to the challenge. So it was across the ideological spectrum, a sense of crisis, at least among those who follow politics closely at an elite level. I don't know how broadly this understanding was shared among the public. And clearly many issues are a crisis for particular sectors or particular interests in society. So this was a moment where you could point to a broad transcendent, bipartisan, trans-ideological consensus that something had to be done, at least among experts. And so that made that special. And Congress was able to respond to it despite enormous populist pressures to resist that elite reading. of what to do. I think that's one of the questions that the transnational rise of populism poses for democratic governance, not just in the United States, but around the world. To what extent can those who are elected to represent and who have more expertise, have been able to dedicate more time to policy questions, are able to have some freedom from populist pressures to take actions that are difficult to justify using the kind of rhetoric that resonates about, you know, justice and fair play, that resonates with a broad public?
I would add, I think the example would probably be any urgent national security question. So certainly you would see that kind of response to 9/11, where the Congress was prepared to give significant discretionary authority to the president, and, you know, subsequently we passed legislation that jumps over some long-standing concerns that many in Congress had with respect to what was necessary to safeguard the nation. You know, I would remind everybody, not that this crowd necessarily needs reminding, but it's not as though the meeting on September 18th was the first indicator we had that there were financial problems. You had had the failure of Lehman. You had had large numbers of the banking houses, the financial houses were in a period of crisis. You had had legislation. It was the imminence of the necessity of action which was the issue. It wasn't that the crisis precipitated out of, you know, a 48-hour period. And just to follow up, I know we're close. I would just draw the distinction between that sense of crisis, or the crisis that resulted from 9/11, versus what we're being told is a crisis today, where there is no evidentiary record that there was really a crisis other than it being manufactured in largely one person's mind, and the empirical evidence doesn't warrant that. And I think that's why you don't see the kind of bipartisan coalition build or popular opinion build that you did when there was something as imminent as 9/11 or the fiscal crisis.
Last word, Dan.
I'll try to address the first question then, because I agree with what they said. The difference between the TARP legislation in 91 and 89 was those things went through regular order. We'd have loved to have had the time to put TARP through regular order. I know John and the people on the Hill would have loved to have had the time to put it through regular order. But we were being told, and going to the other question a little bit, that, you know, if we took too long, you know, the markets were going to freeze up. People wouldn't be able to get money out of their ATMs. Their savings were going to dry up. That, you know, it was cataclysmic predictions, and so that's why it was rushed so quickly.
Thank you, and join me in thanking the panel for an exciting discussion.